From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. Earlier this spring, New Yorkers Amber Rose Isaac and Bruce McIntyre were getting ready to welcome their first child. They'd been dating for 2 years, but had known each other much longer.
I actually tried to talk to her 6 years ago, and she turned me down because she was just so focused on school and her career.
Amber was 26 and working in early childhood education. She was about to get her master's. Bruce was 28 and was working in finance.
Amber was very excited to have a baby. This is what we planned for. We planned months in advance for this.
The couple was aware of some scary statistics, that women like Amber, who was Black and Puerto Rican, are more likely to die from pregnancy-related complications than white women. In New York, the rate of death for Black moms is 8 times higher. They were trying to do everything right.
Strictly vegan, very healthy woman. She'd make sure that we're reading stories to the baby every night, sing to the baby, talk to the baby every single night.
She'd often share her thoughts on Twitter about how active the baby was in her belly, about how her baby shower was thwarted by the pandemic. On April 17th, Amber sent what would turn out to be her final tweet, saying that she couldn't wait to write a tell-all about her experience with her doctors. Days later, she died at Montefiore Medical Center, the Bronx hospital where she'd been getting care.
She ended up passing away after midnight. My son was born around 10:30 that night on 420.
Bruce was left behind with their newborn baby boy, Elias.
Of course, every day is hard. Mornings are hard, nights are hard.
After her death, Amber's final tweet went viral. A local news outlet reported on it, other media picked it up, and her story was the latest rallying cry for the issue of Black maternal mortality. During her pregnancy, Bruce and Amber had been unhappy with the way hospital staff treated her. They said the staff was rude and unprofessional to her during office visits. And then the pandemic hit. In March, Amber had to switch to online doctor visits. Bruce says she tried to get an in-person appointment, but didn't get one until April 17th, the day of her last tweet. When she went in, they found out she developed HELLP syndrome, a rare pregnancy complication that affects the blood and the liver. It's rarely fatal. And Bruce told us that had they known that earlier, Amber could have gotten treatment for it. On April 20th, the hospital staff induced her labor, then performed an emergency C-section.
They came in, I was singing to the stomach so Elias could, you know, be prepared and alert that he's coming. I said my goodbyes to Amber. I didn't get to give her a hug or a kiss because I had to wear PPE.
She died shortly after the operation. Bruce told us and other media that her platelet levels were so low that she bled out. The hospital wouldn't confirm that and declined an interview. But in a statement, a spokesperson said that most of their deliveries are minority mothers and that their maternal mortality rate is low. Any maternal death is a tragedy, the statement said. Our hearts go out to Miss Isaac's family. Baby Elias, born about 6 weeks early, is doing well.
Oh, Elias is phenomenal. I was able to bring him home after the first week. When he hears my voice, he'll light up, he'll start smiling, because me and Amber were always talking to him.
In the week since Amber's death, Bruce has been speaking out and connecting with people all over the country. He's becoming an advocate for reproductive justice.
What I went through should never happen to anyone, especially if it's avoidable.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that around 700 women die from pregnancy-related complications each year, and that the majority of those deaths could be prevented. The rate of deaths for Black moms is 3 to 4 times higher than the rate for white moms. I talked to Joya Creer Perry, an OBGYN and founder of the National Birth Equity Collaborative.
We know that the United States has the worst outcomes for maternal health than any industrialized country in the world. I have, you know, a Black daughter who is more likely to die in childbirth than I was when I had her 27 years ago.
She told me that what Bruce shared has heartbreaking similarities to the stories she's heard from so many families of women who died in childbirth.
She advocated very much so for her own health. She was worried about not being heard, not being listened to. And ultimately, she died in childbirth. And when we look around the different medical reasons that women are dying in childbirth, things like hypertension, high blood pressure, or having a blood clot, or having a heart attack, despite income, education, and weight, Black women are still more likely to die. So it's not because we're not getting prenatal care. It's not because we are too obese or we don't listen. When you control for all those things, we are still more likely to die. So what happens, the difference is how they are treated and seen inside of those systems.
We know that whether it's asthma or heart disease or even COVID-19, the rates are higher in the Black population. And Joya wants to be very clear about the reasons why.
There's no magic Black gene. I'm sitting here with my Afro and my Black skin, but that has nothing to do with my biology as far as my increased risk of having a baby early. That's due to the impact of racism on my body, not that I was innately, inherently broken. So that is why it's so critical for us to move away from saying Black is the risk factor to racism is the risk factor, because the thing that harms Black people is not our mere existence. It's all of the policies and the cultural beliefs that we are broken that harm Black people and our health.
She draws the lines from those cultural beliefs all the way back to slavery, and in particular, a man named James Marion Sims.
In gynecology, we use Sims retractors, Sims speculums.
Sims invented the speculum that patients still encounter today at the gynecologist. He developed surgical techniques that led to him being known as the father of modern gynecology. And he did this by experimenting on enslaved Black women in the 1840s, performing operations on them, sometimes dozens of times, without anesthesia.
Truthfully, I did not, as an OBGYN, learn about the father of modern gynecology, what he fully represented, until I started studying reproductive justice. Talk about how we need to change medicine. Instead of just memorizing the names of the instruments, we need to tell the real story and the real truth around him exploiting Black women's bodies for his own professional career and how that shows up today when we provide care to Black and brown patients.
For decades, there was a 9-foot-tall bronze statue of Sims in New York Central Park. Community organizer Jewel Cadet says she passed that statue for most of her life without a second thought.
Like many New Yorkers, we walk past statues and monuments all the time and don't really read about who these people are.
But a few years ago, Jewel came to understand Sims as a towering symbol of oppression.
J. Marion Sims violated Black women and girls' bodies.
In 2017, as Confederate statues were coming down across the country, momentum built to get the Sims statue removed.
We have nothing to lose but our chains!
We have nothing to lose but our
chains! In August of that year, Jewel was a part of a protest. She and three other Black women stood before the statue wearing white hospital gowns.
We asked if there was a white person who would be willing to splatter mock blood that we had in a water bottle in our uterine region, and we are doing this chant. We have an altar space to the right of where the statue was, because we really wanted to say that, you know, we are invoking the spirits and honoring our ancestors who had their bodies mutilated.
Photos from this protest went viral and boosted calls from the community to take it down.
Mr. de Blasio, tear down this statue!
Take it down!
The city finally removed the statue in April of 2018. But a larger conversation about the legacy of Sims and his work continued. Reveals Priska Neely digs into that complicated story.
When these protests started gaining national attention, news headlines framed things this way. Was Sims a medical hero or a monster? Savior or butcher?
Those either-or framings are really problematic because the world tends to be a little bit more complicated than that.
That's medical historian Deirdre Cooper Owens. Her book, Medical Bondage, Race, Gender, and the Origins of American Gynecology, came out in the heat of the statue debate.
Journalists would ask me, so do you think the statue should stay or go? And I would tell them I'm not really interested in that. Because eventually something's going to happen. It's either going to stay or it's going to leave. What are we actually doing to talk about the effects of medical racism?
Deirdre says, though it may be easy to just focus on Sims and label him as a boogeyman, at that point in history, his methods were common practice.
There were many folk like him, Southern white men, during the antebellum era who had experimented on enslaved people, and in particular in gynecology. And this is not in defense of him. This is showing when you exceptionalize people, that then flattens out, in my opinion, the argument around the systemic nature of oppression.
At the time, 2 decades before slavery was abolished in the United States, this system of oppression was the law of the land, and those norms shaped medicine. There was no criticism of his methods back then.
In terms of Sims' public profile, I mean, he was an international medical superstar.
His claim to all that fame was a surgical technique that fixed a painful childbirth injury, known then as the vesicovaginal fistula. We're going to describe the injury in a few seconds, so just a heads up in case that sort of thing makes you squeamish. Dr. Lewis Wall is a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Washington University in St. Louis.
Basically stated, a fistula is a hole that opens up between a woman's bladder and her vagina as the result of a childbirth complication through which urine runs in a continuous stream.
These horrifying injuries occur after labor goes on for days, when the baby can't fit through the birth canal. In these early days of surgery, C-sections weren't an option. And with this hole there, the women were left incontinent, suffering from inflammation and intense odor. Doctors had tried various sutures to repair the fistula, but they didn't work.
It was regarded as one of the accursed afflictions of surgery because nobody could figure out how to fix these injuries.
This is where Sims comes in. He was a family practitioner working on plantations in Alabama when he first saw a fistula in an enslaved woman. He considered it incurable. But after doing more examinations, he wanted to find a solution. Sims put out a call for enslaved women with the condition and made an arrangement with their owners to keep them. In his memoir called The Story of My Life, Sims describes working at his 8-bed hospital on the corner of his yard. From 1845 to 1849, he performed experimental surgeries on maybe a dozen women, some as young as 17. And finally, after what was the 30th operation he performed on a woman named Anarka, he found a lasting fix. That's not 30 operations overall. That's 30 operations on Anarka alone. This may sound shocking today, but Professor Lewis Wall has published articles in medical journals arguing that the charges that have been made against Sims are largely without merit.
Sims operated on these women with the legal consent of their owners, but they understood what they had to gain by having their injuries cured with a surgical procedure.
Historian Deirdre Cooper Owens disagrees. She says when it comes to these issues around consent, you have to look at the business of slavery and the mindset of the antebellum era.
You have a lot of scholars who have written things to say, well, Sims was benevolent because he took money out of his pocket to take care of these women. And I'm like, no, Sims brokered a business deal with their owners. And so because they were on loan to Sims to repair, that's how it went.
The enslaved women were valuable property for their owners that ensured the institution of slavery would continue. This is why Deirdre also wants to challenge the notion that Sims was a butcher.
Black women's wombs literally propagated and maintained wealth for the white men and white women who owned them. And so no slave owner worth his or her salt is going to intentionally cause harm to a black woman's reproductive system.
In the years it took to come up with a successful repair for the fistula, Sims failed so many times that other doctors stopped wanting to help. His surgical assistants quit. He writes in his book, "At last, I performed operations only with the assistance of the patients themselves." The enslaved women became his surgical assistants.
they are standing in the roles that young white men who were literate stood in. It was because of your team of Black enslaved women assistants who were also your patients, you know, that he was able to finally get it right.
We only know the names of three of Sims' patients, Lucy, Betsy, and Anarka. There were more who endured these surgeries. We don't know their side of the story.
I think this is the most frustrating part for me as someone who studies enslaved people's lives. Most enslaved people were illiterate. Everything that I'm uncovering about these enslaved women is through the writings of the men who owned them, who treated them, who experimented on them.
And there's another layer to this erasure. Most summaries of Sims's work refer to the hospital he founded in New York as the first hospital for women in the United States, glossing over the hospital on the corner of his yard in Alabama, the place where he made his most notable discoveries.
Anti-Blackness can lead you to totally erasing that slave hospital existed. And it wasn't because Sims said it. It was literally because Black people didn't matter. And so that's why the first sentence on the first page of my book says, the first hospital for women in the United States was on a slave farm.
Remember them. Anarka. Lucy. Betsy. The mothers of modern gynecology.
I asked Jewel Cadet, the activist who protested the statue in New York, what she thought of Deirdre's book and her efforts to complicate the narrative.
So it's not what's going to come out of my mouth, but it's going to come out of Deirdre's mouth, and that's important too. But I think that we're both saying that Lucy, Betsy, Arnica put their bodies on the line and were treated as less than, and also like that's how Black people are still being treated.
An African-American artist has been commissioned to create a new piece to go where the Sims statue once stood. Her proposed design features a winged woman, a Black angel, holding the staff of Asclepius, the medical symbol with the serpent-entwined rod. Images of women will be etched onto the body of the angel to honor the unknown. The Sims statue was supposed to be relocated and displayed at the Brooklyn Cemetery where he's buried. I contacted the cemetery. They say for now, it's in storage.
That's Reveal's Priska Neely. Racism has continued to show up in the field of women's health up until the present day. Next, we look at a commonly used calculator that may be leading Black and Latina women to C-sections they don't need. That's next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Reveal is brought to you by Progressive Insurance, committed to offering a streamlined shopping experience where home and auto can be bundled together. Now that's Progressive. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And from Noom. Noom is here for people providing information about how we can all stay well, physically, mentally, and emotionally, by offering support and guidance to navigate a healthy lifestyle with new challenges. More at Noom.com.